You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
It's the first time that Apple have actually decided to tell people about something that they're developing.
High-speed broadband. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
The three main spamming countries are the United States, China, and South Korea.
And I've got some residual powers.
Sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
Senator Coonan, the voice of reason.
There's a couple of systems on a gantry that's actually based on a military missile tracking system.
You put the date on ePray, and you get a whole service just on it.
How does it go?
IE7, you were having trouble installing it because you had a genuine copy of Windows that wouldn't validate properly. What did you have to do to get past that?
Built a new machine.
But how hard can it be?
No, it's not hard at all.
At the end of the day, the photography is all about the person's eye and what they see.
If you find something that's inappropriate about your child, you need to do something about it because it will not go away.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Tech Talk Radio. I'm your host, Andrew McComb. Well, what a show we have for you today. Not one, but two of the biggest technology companies in the world talk exclusively to Tech Talk Radio. Adam catches up with Paul Colley, Sony Australia's Communications and Technology Manager, to find out about Sony's view on the digital living room. And let's just say he's having second thoughts about Apple. The Digital Living Network Alliance, or DLNA, is set to become Sony's conduit to connect the company's products together. Yes, finally, Ethernet finds its way to the back of the latest incarnation of the Bravia TV range. And all I can say is it's about time too. But I'm sure you're all thinking the same thing too. According to Sony's website, the Digital Living Network Alliance is an organisation established to enhance the interoperability of home networks. The organisation issues design guidelines to support the seamless sharing of video, music, photographs and other content through home networks. It also issues a logo for the use on products that qualify under these guidelines. Sony established the DLNA in June 2003 after convincing other manufacturers of the need to improve interoperability through industry-level standardization initiatives. Sony continues to play a leading role in the organization, and a Sony executive is chairman of the DLNA Board of Directors. Currently, DLNA consists of over 240 members, including the world's leading manufacturers of electrical appliances, mobile equipment and computers, as well as developers of software, devices, services and applications, not to mention content providers. By supplying a wide variety of DLNA-compliant products, these manufacturers are helping to raise awareness of DLNA as an industry standard for home networking. So, at last, a flat-screen TV worth buying. Also this week, Lydia Davis finds her way to the Google headquarters in Mountain View, California, to find out firsthand the latest information web designers and bloggers need to know if they wish to be found for all the right reasons. Nathan Jones is a Google Search Quality Analyst, and Anindo Mukherjee is a software engineer for search quality. Interestingly, greater emphasis is being placed on who you're hanging out with this time round.
This week on Tech Talk Radio.
Big Pond adds Twitter support to its channel. MySpace in tune at last. Experts warn of a new PDF attack. Workers are likely to lie in emails. China running out of IP addresses. And if you want to grab an early copy of Microsoft's Windows 7 for free, and it's all above board and legal as well, then you can in late October. With a catch, of course. First up, though, here's the latest happenings from the Tech Talk News Desk.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, Google offers $10 million for a world-changing idea. Australians face a long wait for a Google phone. Google launches a new tool to track petrol prices. A single mum convicted of music theft was granted a new trial. And billing bungles hit Victorian gas and power users. This is Tech Talk News. In a challenge directed at Apple's digital music store iTunes, NewCorp's MySpace will now offer digital sales on a new site called MySpace Music. The launch is a joint venture with major labels Sony, BMG, Universal Music, Warner Music and EMI, and was launched last week by News Corp boss Rupert Murdoch in New York. Advertising deals with McDonald's, Toyota's and Sony Pictures have also been organised. The move is a direct challenge at Apple's dominance in the $4.2 billion online music sector, with its iTunes software gaining 80% of Australian online music sales. The launch of the new site is also a comeback at social networking rival Facebook, after MySpace failed to reach its expected revenue level of $1 billion in internet sales in the last year. Facebook recently hit the 132 million member mark, while MySpace has remained steady at 120 million members. Unlike iTunes, MySpace Music allows users to stream music online and create playlists for free, but must purchase tracks if they want a copy of songs on other devices, like an MP3 player. Search engine giant Google is celebrating its 10th birthday by launching a competition called Project 10 to the 100th, which will look for world-changing ideas. The five best ideas will receive $10 million worth of funding. Google said in a website posting, "Our company's very name expresses our goal of achieving great results through smart technology that starts small and scales dramatically over time to have a tremendous long-term impact." The deadline for ideas is the 20th of October. A panel of Google employees will pick the 100 best submissions, and then Google users will vote to pick the 20 finalists, and a Google advisory panel will select the five winners. Google says it does not want to be prescriptive on the kind of ideas it wants to see, but the Project 10 to the 100th website suggests some categories and guide questions that might help you refine your thinking. Australian technology lovers were amongst the first people in the world to get their hands on Apple's 3G iPhone, which was released in July. But gadget freaks keen to get their hands on the new G1 mobile phone, the first smartphone to be powered by Google's Android mobile software platform, are not going to be so lucky. No launch date has been set for the Australian release of the device, which goes on sale in the US on the 22nd of October. Most Australian analysts are predicting the phone won't land down under until the second quarter of 2009. Google Australia spokesperson Rob Shilkin could not confirm the launch date. Meanwhile, reviews of the G1 are rolling in from the US and Europe. The general consensus seems to be that while the G1 cannot match the iPhone's sleek design and finish, the Android software platform is impressive. Also this week, Google has launched a new tool to help motorists find the cheapest fuel in their area. The Petrol Price Tracker gadget, which has been created in partnership with petrol price monitoring company Motormouth, lets users find the price of unleaded petrol, diesel, LPG and other fuel types. Simply type in an address or postcode and the fuel tracker will display prices and nearby service stations. Australia is the top-ranking country in the world for searches on fuel prices since 2004 and the second-ranked for searches on petrol prices after New Zealand. The number of searches on both phrases has doubled in Australia in the last 4 years. Price data, which is compiled by Motormouth, will be supplied twice a day between Monday and Saturday and once on Sunday. Motormouth covers around 50% of metropolitan service stations, but will add to this over time. Users need to have a Google account to be able to access this site. In the United States, a judge has ordered a new trial for a woman convicted of pirating music on the internet and denounced the awarding of US$222,000 in damages to record companies as wholly disproportionate and oppressive. Jamie Thomas, a single mother from Minnesota, was convicted in October 2007 in the first such online privacy case in the United States for sharing 24 songs through the Kazaa peer-to-peer file-sharing network. She was ordered to pay $220,000, or $9,250 per song, in damages to six record companies, Capitol Records, Sony BMG, Arista Records, Interscope Records, Warner Brothers, and UMG Recordings. But the judge who presided over the case ordered a new trial last Wednesday, saying he had erred in his instructions to the jury with his interpretation of whether Thomas had actually distributed the music or not. In his ruling, Davis also called on the US Congress to amend the Copyright Act and condemn the jury's damages award against Thomas. Noting that she sought no profit from her acts, Davis wrote that Thomas's conduct was motivated by her desire to obtain the copyrighted music for her own use. And finally this week, thousands of Victorian electricity and gas customers have been hit with billing bungles, then forced to wait on the telephone, sometimes for hours, when they phone to register complaints. The state's Energy and Water Ombudsman, Fiona McLeod, said that the two main culprits were AGL and Origin Energy. Her office had received 14,759 complaints from electricity and gas customers in the 6 months to June 30 this year, up a massive 81% on the previous 6 months. The most complained about companies were AGL and Origin Energy, which both blamed their billing bungles on computer upgrades. AGL, which last month announced a net profit after tax of a mere $355.5 million for 2007 and 8, attracted 4,338 complaints, while Origin Energy scored 2,345. Of the 3,701 complaints about gas, 1,924 were made against AGL and 781 against Origin. Ms. McLeod said that following AGL's billing system upgrade, the company failed to recognise BPAY payments made by 10,000 customers, and reminder notices were sent out in error. Some customers paying by CenterPay, a free direct bill-paying service available to those who receive payments from Centrelink, were also affected. And that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
If you ever pulled a hard drive out of a server, it can burn your fingers.
Oh, yeah. They'd certainly use a lot of power.
Call me now.
Call me now. I'm 0500.
I'm still waiting.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm feeling a little hoarse.
I'm not, actually, but...
Good. Does it say balderdash? Does it say something totally different?
No, it says, is the message true or false?
Maybe it depends on the call centre you get to or the level of training of the operator you get.
Yeah, but the problem was that it was a $4,000 laptop and he's only got a $3,000 check.
Sony always made the best televisions and the best monitors.
Oh, that sucks.
It does. Yeah. And that's nothing in this day and age.
Yeah, you've got this big screen on the device. You're likely to want to subscribe to the odd video podcast as well.
We need a web server. We need a good interface. Good user interface.
Yeah, sure. It's a little bit blocky. It's not that much worse than Foxtel on its cheaper channel.
Jerry Seinfeld's been given the Piper Pass, hasn't he?
That's showbiz.
Yeah.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And a very good evening, and a croaky Andrew McComb here this evening. I'll throw it over to Dr. Ron, panellists this evening, Dr. Ron and Graham Callaghan. How are you both?
We're very well. I'm very well, speaking on behalf of...
Yeah, I'm not too bad, thanks.
That's good. I'll just croak over here. You got your boys taking the show, right?
Look after the buttons and things for us.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We'll point towards Andrew if you need to say anything, Andrew. You were croaky last week.
I know. It just went croaky all of a sudden. I think it's just walking into the studio tonight.
What has that effect on you?
It does indeed. Hey, how about Google? 10 years old.
Yeah, they've done extremely well, haven't they?
Not bad for a company that's only 10 years down the track. Who else, can take world dominance in the form of a business in 10 years?
Yeah.
Very good. Apple couldn't do it. They've been around for a bit longer. They're trying very hard, but nonetheless. But, they've got a few competitions out there. Got a good idea for them? $10 million, I think I said in the news. If you come up with a bright idea that's going to change the world.
Yeah, that's right. And then if they can develop it and they can turn it into a marketable product or service.
You don't get any money out of it. They just give the development people $10 million to go and develop your idea.
That's pretty good, though. It's a pretty good incentive, isn't it?
Yeah.
You got any good ideas? You wouldn't be sharing them with us, I suppose.
No.
But
haven't got any good ideas anyway at this point in time. Maybe some people on our forum do. chat.techtalkradio.com.au if you want to talk to us live. Or we have a forum, as we just said, forum.techtalkradio. Don't confuse the two. One's real time. The other can go and contribute to all sorts of things. Anyway, 10 years of Google. Not bad. We've got an interesting show tonight. We've got Sony talking about, Adam caught up with the guys at Sony.
I'm looking forward to hearing
about Ethernet in all your up-and-coming devices. Connectivity in the living room. Who would have guessed?
Sony have got some interesting ideas sometimes. They do some things very well, and there's other things that people curse and swear at Sony and don't like things that they've done. So.
Well, even in the promo, Graham was saying Sony make good televisions.
They do. Well, they always have made good televisions.
They used to, yeah. They're still making good televisions.
There you go. Mm.
Depends on, budget. They're not the cheapest TV around, but they're certainly a damn fine one.
And then I'm looking at that ghastly device in front of you, Andrew, which was good for radio, but it records into an audio format called A-Track, and we need proprietary software to read audio files.
Yes, that's, Sony, that's not really Sony at its best.
It's not Sony at its
Sony
finest.
Sony working against us.
Yeah, so looking forward to hearing what Adam uncovers tonight.
Yes, but then again, everyone tries it. Look at the Zune, for goodness sakes, and things like that. Everyone likes their own proprietary formats, but it all goes belly up after a while. Also, interesting things this week with MySpace Music. Coming online. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, I did hear about MySpace Music.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later on tonight too. Let's start off with something that got under Lydia Davis's goat.
this week.
Got under a goat.
Got under a goat.
Got under my goat too.
Well, you start. It's all to do with Telstra and Twitter.
It's all about Telstra and Twitter. The Telstra twits.
Have they become... Yes, they have.
For those of you that don't know, Twitter is a social networking, or I'd probably describe it as a micro-blogging system. It's a system where you can type in very, very short narrative about what you're doing or what's caught your interest on the net or what's caught your interest
you're
just in day-to-day life.
You're a very active Twitterer, aren't you?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm very active, but I have been using it. I didn't get it to start with. I have to be honest. I just didn't get Twitter. And I looked at it and I thought, yeah, I'm not sort of clicking here. I don't understand what it's all about. But I started using it, and it's a lot of fun, and it's very, very useful. A lot of people do use Twitter, and like at the moment, I was running out the door tonight to come to the radio studio, and I've just put a tweet there which says, Shoutcast stream's running, and running up to the studio. Wonder what happened this week. I don't know. I'll find out when I get there. And anyone who subscribes to my tweets, who wants to see what it is I'm doing, they'll get that. If you're lucky enough now to live in the United States, it used to be anywhere in the world. If you'd like to live in the United States, you can subscribe for free. You can get text messages sent to your phone. So if you're following me, you can get that texted through to your phone.
Yeah, that was a good feature of Twitter that's now gone.
Yeah, it was costing them too much money, unfortunately. Mm. But we digress. Telstra has decided, because we're the tech-savvy, hip, friendly, proactive, customer-responsive organisation that we are.
Yeah, Phil's threatened to come back too.
Oh.
But anyway, that's another story.
We're going to get in on the Twitter caper, and we're going to have real live customer service representatives monitoring Twitter. So you can send us a problem. If you've got a problem with your phone bill, if you've got a problem with your mobile phone, if there's a question that you have about a service that Telstra could provide. Oh, it's Telstra Big Pond it's being marketed as, so I guess it's been
internet
pushed towards
related.
Who have Big Pond accounts. And you can send them a message, and you can say on Twitter, hey, Telstra Big Pond people, I've got an issue at the moment. I don't have service on my Big Pond account. I'm using another one or something. Can you tell me are there any outages? Ah, dear. Well, Telstra, in typical Telstra fashion, have just got... It's either a robot there, or it's customer service representatives with 1, 2, or 3 canned responses. And all I can do on
the
screen...
What's the difference between that and a robot?
Well, there isn't any to you and I and to Graham. So all they're doing is just pressing buttons that say, hi, thanks for your inquiry. Telstra would really like to help you. Why don't you go to this URL, click on this link and go to the web form and tell us more about it. And that's all it is. If you look at their channel, if you view all their messages, there's 15 or 20 in a row which are word for word identical. Hi, thanks for your inquiry. Telstra would like to hear more about this. Why not send us an email? We'd really like to help you with that inquiry. Why don't you send us an email?
I didn't think you could email the phone company.
That's a good question. Why don't you fill out our web form? We'd like to help. Our operators are standing by. It's painful. It's like pulling teeth. Telstra, if you want to do this, it could be such a good service, and it could be so useful to so many people, like their live chat facility is, where you can go and chat live to an operator in text mode. That works very well. They should do something like that. But to have these canned responses and to steer people away from the medium that they've chosen, to force them to go to a web form or to use email, it's mindless. And a lot of people are very upset and passionate about this.
It'll only do their reputation. It'll tarnish it. It'll push it downhill because they're not using the technology for what it's designed to be used for.
Exactly.
They're there because they can, and they don't understand it properly. And it'll just show, and well, anyway, the history will write them accordingly. They drew parallels to Second Life the other day.
Oh, Second Life.
How 80s is Second Life?
I was compelled sufficiently to write a blog entry in my personal blog, and I said, yes, made a mention about their presence on Second Life, and I said, try getting a First Life first.
Yeah.
Pointed people at the Get a First Life link.
It would do them good. Can I tell you about one of my consumer technological dilemmas during the course of the week?
Have a dilemma?
It just doesn't happen to every... You know, it doesn't happen to the mums and dads of the world. It happens to us too. And yes, I called the voice over IP telephone company Engine.
Yes, yes.
During the course of the week. Yep. I chose... Because their really ordinary waiting on hold for 50 minutes type, support phone number.
50 minutes?
50 minutes. I decided many moons back to cancel my accounts with them because any company that can't provide some level of support within a short period of time, I think I told you about it on the radio.
Engine used to be so good. What happened to Engine?
I don't know.
It's gone downhill, haven't
I? I don't know. The next thing, they'll be outsourcing their IT department. We could do them good, actually, but you never know.
No.
But yes, I decided, okay, I'll give this a go. I haven't used them for a while. I'll see how good the voiceover IP is. So I had a couple of what they call voice boxes, which are little boxes which go between your phone and your broadband.
Yes.
Now, I thought, oh, I'll plug one of these in and give it a whirl. And anyway, I thought, great, it works. The green light comes up. It's flashing. It's connected. Yeah, good. Okay. Now, do you think how hard that would be to get that reconnected? Simple concept, you know, I would have thought. Anyway, I rang them up. Actually, no, I didn't. I started on their chat forum, their little chatty thing there, and I spoke to, I don't know, somebody. Now, I asked a few questions, and when the questions got too hard, their person just disappeared.
Oh.
They stopped chatting to me.
Oh.
Not even a bye, not even a thank you, not even call again,
oh,
or please call us on this. They just stopped. They went away.
Maybe they didn't pay their phone bills. Oh, no, yeah, they were chatting. Maybe they didn't pay their internet bill.
Maybe not.
That's a bit wrong.
I thought that was really rude.
Yeah, it is a bit rude.
You know, I'm saying, how can I reconnect this voice box? And she said, actually, the question was, I had to put in a MAC address, which is a little unique identifier into their system. And they said, oh, no, you can't do that. You've disconnected it. I said, yeah, but I want to reconnect it. Oh, no, you've disconnected it. How hard's this? Anyway, I gave up on chat because she went away or he went away, like, whoever it was.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I forced to dial the 1300 number.
Oh.
And I opted for sales because I knew support would take considerable period of time to actually ring them. So I went into sales.
Was your call valuable to them?
Oh, it was.
Yeah.
It was. And even the email that he sent asked me, it said from, you know, dear valued customer.
Oh, said, oh good.
Yeah,
that's good.
Anyway, to cut a long story short, I spoke to this gentleman on the phone whose name was Greg.
Hi, Greg.
He was very helpful.
Oh, good.
He said, oh, you have to fill out this form. I said,
what? For paper form?
How come I have to fill out a form?
Hello, 21st century.
Anyway.
Just fix it.
The long and short of it was he emailed me the form, which was...
Didn't ask you for a fax number. You would have...
He did want it faxed back to him.
Oh, no.
Anyway, at about that point in time, I opened the form up to have a read of it, and it was a full solid page about mother's maiden name, DNA swab, blah, blah, blah. Said, we don't even have
rights to your firstborn, all
that
sort of thing.
Yeah. We don't even have to go through this to connect up at Telstra.
No.
You know, oh, except if you go for MobileNet and you've already got an account.
Yeah,
or is that three?
No, that was me at Telstra. If I already had an account, but I had to pass a credit check to open a new one. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the long and short of it was...
Check it. It's true. Graham's without speech. Go on.
Buried in the bottom of the fine print, I had to pay $33 to get this thing reconnected.
Oh.
I've gone, you're kidding. I can walk down to Dick Smith and buy a new voice box for $19 and you expect me to pay $33?
Yeah.
Anyway.
What was the response?
My response was inactivity on behalf of the consumer. I said, if you're going to treat your customers like this, Engine, go and get your head read.
Mm.
You know, it's supposed to be an easy process.
Mm.
Regardless of who you are, it's supposed to be an easy, seamless process. They put hurdle after hurdle after barrier in front of you.
That's
to try and reconnect a system. Engine, have a good look at your corporate communications. That's all I can say. If you want customers, you're going about exactly the wrong way.
That's disappointing because Engine used to be very responsive and they used to provide a very good service. I'm still an Engine
Absolutely.
Customer.
Yes, I'm an Engine customer again now. I've called up. And Engine, if you'd like to come onto this program and talk to us about it, we're more than happy to have a chat.
Mm.
Like we are. Our doors and microphones are open to any corporate customer who wants to talk about consumers. So there you go. That was my bitter and twisted approach, again, dealing with a telco.
So you're back on Engine anyway, for now.
Yeah, I am for now.
How's your week, Graham? Any dilemmas? Any Engine experiences? Nothing. Any Telstra twits experiences?
Nothing to match that. No.
No?
No.
I don't know. I just...
Comparatively
I've got
boring.
Or something. I don't know. On my forehead.
Comparatively boring and quiet week for you.
Yep.
You've got a new toy. Do you want to tell us about your new toy?
Tell us about your new toy. This is fantastic.
We like new toys. Pity it's not show, but it's tell on radio.
Yeah, I've gone and, as Dr. Ron mentioned before, we've been recording the show on Sony mini discs, which involves compressed audio and a horrible, horrible program that you need to be able to extract the audio back out again to be able to edit it and turn it into the podcast.
Should be a dentistry software, shouldn't
it? Yep. So what I've gone and done, I found this thing on the internet called an M-Audio MicroTrack 2. M-Audio is the company name, so you can go to www.m-audio.com. And the thing's called a MicroTrack 2. It's a professional audio recorder. It records to CF memory cards. You can just pop a card in the side,
so
whatever size you want.
So any compact flash card you can
buy. Any compact flash card,
nick one out of your mobile, go and get one out of your camera, plug it in and away it goes.
And of course, the bigger the card you buy, the more time you can record, or the more cards you buy, you just keep swapping them. It's got it can record either microphone or line level, although I'm working out it's got some limitations recording at line level, but we'll persist with that. But the microphone inputs it's got either normal little small what they call 1/8 inch plugs, which are the 3.5 millimeter plugs we're probably familiar with on your
headphones.
They're the smaller ones. Yep. And it comes with a little stereo T-shaped microphone, which records really nice quality.
Really nice?
Yeah, really nice. It sounds great.
That's good coming from you. You're a bit of an audiophile.
I'm a bit of an audiophile.
Really good,
good. But what it's also got is two, what they call quarter-inch, or what we'd also call 6.5-millimeter connectors, which take balanced inputs. So you just need a little adapter from that to your normal XLR connector. To connect it to professional microphones, including microphones that need phantom power. It can supply phantom power to the microphones.
Now, phantom powering is a microphone which requires a little bit of voltage up its microphone cable to
work.
Yeah,
for condenser-type microphones. Often these are used shotgun-type microphones, things like that, or very high-quality microphones are often that way, used in recording.
48 volts. Careful.
48 volts.
It bites.
Yep. It's very, very low current. Very, very low current. And, yeah, it can record at the lowest quality recording it can do is a bit rate of 44.1K and a bit depth.
The lowest
of 16-bit.
Quality is 44.1K.
Yeah.
Now that's like what we used to think was CD quality.
That's CD quality, yep. The next one up is DVD quality, which is 48K.
Does it do 96?
It'll do all the way up to 96.
Wow, that's impressive.
And it'll do also 24 bits deep, well, if you want a little bit of extra bit depth as well, which gives you an extra bit of dynamic
headroom
range.
Headroom and stuff like
exactly
that.
Exactly right, yeah, exactly.
Good gadget. Could be a gadget of the week, couldn't it?
It's absolutely fantastic gadget. It's got a built-in lithium-ion battery. Just charge it through a USB port. And it can record to MP3 format if you want to.
Why would you want to?
But,
space, I guess.
I'm using it, space, to get really long recordings. If you want to record something that you want to up, if you want to record the podcast and then put it online straight away, then you could do it that way.
Okay.
How
much? What do you expect to pay?
Well, I went out online and did my research. The cheapest price I found by Googling around and going to those shop comparison sites was about $425.
Mm-hmm.
But I got it from a place, I suppose it's acceptable to say where I got it from. I got it from Audio Oz down in St Kilda Road in
Melbourne.
St Kilda in Melbourne.
Yep.
About the same price?
For less than $400, for $379.
Oh, that's great.
That's excellent. Yeah. And you're happy with it, obviously?
I'm trying it now. This is the first night I've used it to record the show.
So if you're listening to us on the podcast, it worked.
That's right. Hopefully the podcast you're listening to is recorded on there. I'm also recording another mini just in case it all goes pear-shaped. But yeah, thanks very much to the guys down at Audio Oz for getting it for me and for getting it at a really good price. And, hopefully it's all going to come together.
Terrific. If you're listening and you're putting a podcast together, or you're thinking of putting podcasts together yourself...
Look, it'll be a great one for just doing your recordings, for doing, I will use it if I do a pre-record of something for the show.
Yeah.
It'll be a great one to take out and do interviews in the field with, too.
Because it's very portable. It's about the size of a mobile phone, something you could hang on to or stick in your pocket very easily.
It's a very small, very light device. There's no problems carrying it about. It comes with, as I say, a T-shaped microphone that's, perfectly acceptable for doing recordings out in the field if you don't have a professional microphone to hook up to it. If you do have professional microphones to hook up to it, even better. It's a great little device. Comes with all the bits and pieces you need too, little lead to turn into a lapel mic and all that sort of stuff as well. So
Warlock on our chat room says M Audio are great for sound cards too, high quality recordings, 24-bit. So they've got a bit of stuff out there, M Audio.
Yeah, they have. They've got a lot of that sort of stuff.
I think everyone needs something like that in their little kit, don't they? Whether you're going to record a school concert or whether you're at work and you need to record something or whatever, and for that sort of money.
The other thing it would be great for would be for recording sound if you're into DVD production or something like that. It would be really good for that.
Let's move on. There's a couple of interesting things in the news this week. We talked about Google. Google's in the news a lot. We're actually talking to them tonight. Well, Lyd is, should I say. She went down to HQ in Palo Alto, or from Palo Alto down to Mountain View.
We've got Lyd on the program tonight.
Yes, we
terrific.
Do.
Terrific. Excellent.
But anyway, a Perth man won $120,000 in a Google competition. A musician from Perth, to be precise, has been handed a $120,000 check from internet giant Google for reaching the finals in a developer's challenge for the new G1 smartphone. Now, have you heard about the G1 smartphone?
Tell us about the G1 smartphone.
Well, this is the first long-awaited, touted phone from Google.
It's not here, though.
No, not in Australia. It's been launched in the States.
Google.
But the G1, it works on an HTC device.
Yep.
But and if you go and have a look on the HTC website, you'll actually find a very interesting demo on it. It does look pretty good. It does some very interesting things. It technically is better than the iPhone in certain areas. Like, for example, it's got a 5-megapixel camera as opposed to a 2-megapixel camera. It's got a lot of inbuilt Google functionality already there, as you'd expect for a Google phone.
MMS?
I haven't read that far. One would only assume. But anyway, the Google phone has been talked about for a long time and has finally hit reality in the United States this week.
Wow.
And the thing that Google put behind it is Android, which is its sort of operating system.
Yep.
Behind the device, which basically just lets it talk seamlessly to all the other Google apps, maps and navigation and mail and all those things.
And let's face it, anything's got to be an improvement over Windows Mobile to be running on your HTC phone.
Yeah. Windows. Why do you speak so highly of Windows Mobile?
Because I use it.
Okay, they're good. So there you go. Steve Oldmeadow won the prize for his application, Rayfala. Which he entered into the Android competition, developer competition. The program is a musical application that allows users to mix and match virtual instruments, take apart a rhythm arcade game, and create music. There you go. Something for everybody on the Google phone, the new G1. So anyway, good on you, that Perth man. I think that's a great achievement
to
win.
Very good.
That sort of stuff.
Very good.
In other interesting news too, which is not on the rundown, because you guys know that I'm contemplating moving into a Nokia-arranged device in the not-too-distant future.
I thought that was a Twilight Zone Tech Talk episode.
No. See, Nokia are doing some interesting things. The N96 is scheduled for launch in Australia very shortly, December, which is a bit of an iPhone killer, apparently.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. There's a few journos have got devices to have a look at the moment. But on top of that, when Nokia introduced the 96 in Australia at a press briefing, they've also said that they're actually bringing out a new device called the Nokia Tube. Now, the Nokia Tube is a full touchscreen device, which is yet again having a go at what Apple have bought out with the iPhone. Nokia gave the details of the new device back in April, and now a leaked image of the Tube has emerged, and all reports say that it will be launched on the 2nd of October. So that's between now and our next show. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. Our next show being our 200th show too, believe it or not.
200 Tech Talks.
Are you coming?
I'll let you know. Yeah. Am I invited?
That's the attitude, isn't it? Maybe I don't get a better offer.
Am I welcome? Am I invited?
Of course you're welcome,
Doctor. Nice to know.
Adam Turner's going to pop in too, I believe. Lydia might join us live from the United States.
That'd be good.
And Dr. Ron's going to snub us.
He's got a better offer. Right, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And other interesting news this week too, Red Hat to release a supercomputing distribution. Now, Graham, do you know anything about this? Red Hat will announce its first high-performance computing, otherwise known as HPC, because you've got to have an acronym in this business.
Yes, you do.
Yeah. Optimized distro. There's another, you know, trendy hip word, distro, short for distribution.
Distro.
I love the way they put this. These are even in the press releases now. The Red Hat of Red Hat HPC on the 7th of October. The distro is a step forward from the current Red Hat Enterprise Linux for HPC computing nodes. You could probably put this on your Cray that you could buy. You could lose the Microsoft operating system. That was our gadget of the week last week.
Yeah, blow that away once you've bought the Cray and
load up your Red Hat. Because you could certainly take advantage of the 26 dual-core processors in it with Red Hat, surely.
Scream along.
You'd even run a GUI on it.
Would. Yeah, almost. You could almost run a GUI on it.
The current offerings, Red Hat Enterprise, are based on the standard distro, but these are going to be tailored for node running on the new HPC workloads. So they've obviously got new threats. Do you know much about it yet, Graham, or is this all news?
No, this is one I hadn't come across, but yeah.
Stick with us. You'll go places. It came out today. Also, another by-the-by. You can all have a bit of a chuckle before we hit the main rundown. Oh, look at the time already. The DRAM prices. You know the DRAM that we buy, which goes in those memory slots in our computers?
Yeah.
They're at 18%, or they plunged 18% in the last 2 weeks.
RAM has been very cheap lately already, so...
Yeah, seriously low prices, because there's too many companies making RAM and they all have to compete.
Yep.
And as a result, it's been pushing the market prices lower. Mm. But all of those 18 companies that make RAM sort of bet on one major player doing something remarkable, and that is Microsoft with Vista.
Yep.
And because the take-up on Microsoft with Vista has been so slow, because it's a very memory-hungry operating system, the anticipated demand of sales of RAM, they just haven't been.
Mm.
So now they've got all this spare stuff and they've got to dump it on the market. So that's why if you want RAM, there's never been a better time.
Now, RAM has always, for a long time, been the most cost-effective way that you can upgrade your PC and actually feel your machine running faster. Putting more RAM in, if your machine's not running as fast as it should, and it's not, assuming it's not full of spyware or something, then putting more RAM in it is more likely to make more difference for less dollars than anything else you're likely to do. So, if you're running the normal versions of Windows, anything up to 4 gigabytes of RAM is going to be useful to you. Anything beyond that and your machine's going to completely ignore it, so don't go beyond 4 gigabytes. But, yeah, go out and stick, 2 or 4 gig of RAM in your machine.
Yeah,
and
RAM it up, baby.
Yeah.
That's what you gotta do.
Your Windows XP machine will start to fly. You'll love it.
Do you have to have the same types of memory sticks or RAM sticks, Graeme, in a computer? Is that an urban myth or is that a reality?
Well, to some degree, it's an urban myth. Yeah, you don't need to. If you've got some memory that's running faster than other memory, then it's probably... your fast memory is probably being slowed down to the speed of your slow memory in some cases. And in some cases...
So memory has speed as well as the capacity.
That's right, yep. So you've got to watch for that. And you've got to sort of work out what the right memory is for your motherboard, there's little utilities out there that will help you to...
I was going
to
ask you if you'd thrown away the box that it came in.
If you've thrown
and
away the box,
the manual,
you can still figure it out. You can, if you're a home user, you can run something like Bellarc Advisor that will tell you exactly what...
it's not a gadget. Is that a good bit of software, is it?
It's a little bit of software, that can just do it. Does a complete audit of your machine, including what memory slots it's got and what motherboard you've got in it and all that sort of stuff. So it can help you to work out what to do.
Fantastic.
Get some info that you can sort of post even on the forum and,
that'd be good.
Technical people will be able to advise you.
Let's go to the rundown, shall we?
Oh.
And then we'll go to a break.
Oh, right. We're going to break with tradition.
Wouldn't get
do
too carried away.
No, absolutely. We'll breeze through all these. In fact, we'll probably drop a few. But anyway, that's life. MySpace in tune at last. MySpace being the social networking site that it is, owned by the Rupert Murdoch Empire News Corp, has finally decided to launch an online music option, because a lot of people are doing this now to try and take away a bit of the market dominance from iTunes, which obviously fairly recently. But Australia's online networkers have again been forced to wait for their chance to join the next wave of digital revolution, with MySpace launched in the US last week. Obviously, they do everything over there. That's where he lives now, isn't it? The long-awaited showdown between iTunes and the social networking site's foray into selling tunes kicked off in the US, where members can now buy downloads via Amazon's MP3 store from MySpace. The MySpace music site allows users to create unlimited playlists, and they can post one of 10 tracks to their profile page. So there you go. It's here. Another one, if people want to go and buy stuff.
There is nothing that drives me more batty than a web page with music that starts playing as it's loading.
Yep.
Drives me out of crazy.
No, the worse than the website with a music track that plays as soon as you load it, there is definitely a worse one. And that's the website with multiple different music tracks that start playing as soon as you load it.
I've been to MySpace is like that.
Yes.
It just drives you batty. You get two media controls on the web page, and one starts playing something and one starts playing something else.
Yep. and then five minutes later, a YouTube video loads down the bottom and it starts playing as well.
That's
and
it.
Yeah,
that's
it's really good.
That's great. Yeah.
Go MySpace. Literally, go. Get out of here. Go.
Andrew, pull us out of this dive.
For those of you who live in Britain, and Dr. Ron, you've been there just recently, they're going to unveil, or they have unveiled, a new identity card, just because they can. Jackie Smith, there's a fairly anonymous name, really, isn't it? Unveiled a card which is to be issued to the people outside the European Economic Area, renewing their permission to stay in Britain as students on a basis of marriage. Up to 60,000 cards will be handed out between November and March, in the first large-scale production of the 4.7 billion identity card scheme. The red and blue card bears the royal crest plus the shamrock, sorry, the Royal Crest plus the Shamrock. What's the Shamrock? Is that their logo, like a coat of arms? Is that what they call a Shamrock?
Shamrock will represent Ireland in some way.
Yes, the Republic of Ireland.
Good, because that's why we're on the other side of the world. We got exported from there, didn't we? Yeah, good. So anyway, it's got the Shamrock, the daffodil, thistle and rose as symbols representing four countries making up the United Kingdom.
Yes. Makes sense.
There you go. So, yeah, another identity card to produce, to produce, I guess, at airports and local, you know, I don't know where they make up 100 points over there, but it's like Medicare card really here, isn't it?
Should be more of it.
Amazing things.
Need one here. Chip and pin, they say over there. Chip and pin.
What's that?
Chip and pin.
Oh, is that when it's like running your Visa card through something and putting...
Yeah, everything over there with the credit cards has a... it's like one of the big old-fashioned SIM cards. It's got the chip in it, and you have to use a pin number. They don't actually... Oh, it's rare, I found, to sign for things. So all my credit cards don't have chips in them.
Yep.
We don't have chips in our cards here the same way that they do in Europe and the United Kingdom.
So they had to find the special machine that they could swipe it through because they weren't used to having to swipe it.
Yeah, you mean one like that?
That's exactly what Andrew's holding.
So is he holding up Exhibit A to the microphone? Can you see that at home?
Chip and pin.
There is a chip in my card. And that's why I can pin it.
Have you ever used it?
Absolutely. I don't sign for anything on my credit card anymore.
Yeah, but hang on. I don't have to sign on my credit card either, but I haven't got a chip in it.
No, you use a pin number, but you've got the magnetic.
Yeah, I still swipe it with a magnetic stripe, but I can use the pin now that I couldn't before. But I don't have a chip like Andrew's does.
There's a lot of machines over there, I noticed, where you put the card in and then they'll start putting groceries through the cash register, for example, and start telling things up. And you leave the card in there for the duration of that process.
Well, so you go down,
put your pin number in, take
download
it out,
your receipt or something off.
And off you go, yeah. And they look at you, oh dear, no, you need to sign a piece of paper. I have to go and get that machine. Hang on a minute, go and do that. But it's all it's a security measure, and I suppose it puts the onus back on the card holder. You have to know the pin number. I said pin number, they didn't know. You have to know the pin. If you're signing for something, the onus is on the vendor to actually check the signature. Changing where the responsibility for the transaction lies.
Yeah, so don't write your pin number on your card or anything silly like that.
No, anymore.
Really? I'm glad. We're running late now. It's time for a break. We'll be back with more in a moment.
You're listening.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you. You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio.
If you listen to Tech Talk Radio live, you've probably wondered why you can't chat with the panellists in real time. Surely such technology exists. Well, now it does. chat.techtalkradio.com.au. By popular demand, you can now chat real time with panellists and other Tech Talk enthusiasts. All you need is a web browser, an internet connection, and a comfy chair. Monday nights at 8 p.m, go to chat.techtalkradio.com.au.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb, fairly croaky this evening. Hopefully JD's feeling a little bit better too. One of our regular panellists, he's on the chat at the moment saying he's not coming in because he'll spread his germs around. So very nice of you, JD. Hope you're feeling better. Hope you make it in for our 200th show.
And now, speaking of the chat, now, Warlock on our chat has come up with an interesting story relating to pin numbers. Apparently a customer of one of Australia's major banks, I won't tell you which bank,
Really? That's okay. Really good. Thanks.
had one of their ATMs.
Can I spell mortgage?
I wouldn't know.
Sorry for our overseas viewers. That's a local gag because it refers to a current television campaign on one of our banks.
They had one of their ATMs painted to remove the graffiti that had cropped up around it, and one of the customers came into the branch and complained bitterly because it turned out he'd scratched his PIN number into the paint next to the ATM so he wouldn't forget it, but they painted over it. Thanks, Warlock, for that story. I have no idea if it's true or not, but it makes a good story.
Don't let the facts get in the way of a good story. That's fine.
If you'd like to chat to us in real time while we're on air, go to chat.techtalkradio.com.au.
Yeah, you'll hear all sorts of gems like that from the blokes.
Now, just as a word of warning to anyone listening to Tech Talk Radio now, whether you're, put it this way, if you're listening to us on a pod stream or listening to us on the chat, we are changing time zones next week. Did you know?
Oh, yes, we are.
Oh, okay.
We start daylight saving.
We do. So our show will be an hour earlier if you're living somewhere else. Is that right?
Does that mean I get...
Do we wind our clocks back or forward?
No, we're spring forward, fall back. Forward.
Okay, so that means we're an hour later.
We might be 2 hours later because in the UK, they'll go back an hour.
Yes, because UK will come off daylight savings.
Oh, yeah. Good. Yeah, no, it's all early this year. We've the whole eastern seaboard of Australia. If you're living and listening to us on the eastern seaboard, just ignore what we're talking about now. But if you're anywhere outside that, it all changes.
Check our forum and our website for details. We'll put all the information there.
Good.
Someone will.
Oh, dear. Yes, our 200 show next week, we're going to be giving away a Maxtor hard drive.
Oh, what? Really?
We are. To someone who's on our chat. So make sure you're on our chat next year.
Where do all these Maxtor hard drives come from?
Your house, apparently.
Yeah, they do, actually. They're just reconditioned secondhand.
No, not at all. This is brand new gear. This is top-notch stuff that Maxtor have been kind enough to provide us with.
Absolutely. A lovely 750-gig toy for someone out there on the chat or on the forum. So make sure you get your time zones right and come and join us next week.
Dr. Ron's had to restrain himself all this time.
Yes, we're sitting on his desk
there. Brand new hard drive sitting on the bench there. I'm going to let it touch.
It's not for you, it's for the listeners.
For a listener of, yes. Because we gave one away recently, didn't we?
Yeah.
To Dwayne. The big hard drive competition.
In Western Australia. He picked that one up. Yeah. That was very good. All right, what else was I going to say? Oh, I can't remember. Let's talk about Sony, shall we?
Yeah.
Because we...
We mentioned them last week.
We did. And now Adam's been up to speak to Sony in Sydney at a recent launch of their new technology products. And one of the big news items is that they're actually ramping up their DLNA, which you've got to have acronyms.
You have to have TLAs and FLAs.
No, this is an enhanced TLA, this one.
It's got an extra letter in it.
It's an FLA.
Is it?
Yeah.
Mm. Anyway, the Digital Living Network Alliance.
Told you.
It could refer to anything. Could talk about plankton in the sea, really, doesn't it? But
Digital Living Network Alliance.
Yeah. Basically, it means networking all your good toys in your living room together.
Oh, well, that's...
Home entertainment, broadband, and all that sort of stuff.
That's an admirable goal.
Yeah, now, it is, actually. I'm going to be talking about this and other things on ABC Radio on Friday, because I'm spruiking the Tech Talk Radio 200 show on ABC Radio, because that's what you can do these days. So watch out. You better come along.
It's all about cross-promotion.
Absolutely, cross-promotion. So make sure you come along, because there might get a few other listeners coming in to pick up a hard drive. You never know, but anyway,
listen to Afternoons on ABC Adelaide.
Absolutely. That's a good station, that. Carol Wallach, she's great. Hey, Adam Turner went to have a bit of a chat to the guys in Sydney about it, and I don't know, maybe he's become a bit disillusioned in what Apple isn't doing, because he's been on about that for many weeks now, about whether... Mr. Jobs is going to do anything about his living room with his Mac Mini and all that. But anyway, he went and had a look at some of the offerings that Sony have and talked to the powers that be there about what's happening in the land of home entertainment from Sony's point of view. Here's Adam's view from the couch.
I've always said my next toaster needs to have Ethernet. And now Sony's coming close to delivering that dream of connectivity in everything. I dropped by Sony's Uchi Home Entertainment Product Roadshow last week, and it's clear the boffins in the Sony Labs have been working hard to deliver on my dream of Ethernet in everything. Apparently Uchi is Japanese for house or home or paying the Sony logo tax so all your gear plays nicely together. Something like that. Anyway, I had a chat with Sony, and this is what they had to say.
My name's Paul Colley from Sony Australia. I'm Technology Communications Manager. And one of the things we're demonstrating here is the whole connected network, which is known as DLNA, which basically just means that the consumer electronics devices can talk to each other and share content. So you can share your music from one device to the next, or your photos or your videos. And some of the things that we've just launched here today are the new Bravia TVs that have DLNA connectivity, so you can actually connect them to your network at home. and you can stream photos and music from your collection that might be on your computer or on your hi-fi system somewhere else, and you can stream them straight through to your TV or through to your hi-fi system. So what this does is it basically brings all of our content off our PC, where we often collect all of our thousands of photos and all our thousands of music tracks, and we can take them off there and experience them in the area where we actually set ourselves up to enjoy our entertainment, which is the lounge room. Yeah. So we can actually, just using the cross-media bar, which a lot of people are familiar with, which is the interface from the PlayStation 3, which is very easy to use. People can just navigate to their photos or to their music, and they can just stream that straight down to the TV and enjoy that from the comfort of their lounge room.
So how is the television connected to the other equipment?
So the television is connected to the network with Ethernet, or if you want to do it wirelessly, you can put a wireless router on the back of the TV. And then your computer, for example, has you can share the content on your computer through Windows Media Player, and you can turn that on and share all your favourite tunes and your favourite photos, and they just see each other. So you just select to find new media servers. It takes about 30 seconds, and the computer will appear on the menu system of the TV, and you just start exploring it. It's very, very simple.
And so what are your plans for putting Ethernet ports in other devices?
Well, obviously, DLNA gives us the opportunity to start sharing our content like never before. So Howard Stringer, who's the COO of Sony Corporation, has announced that he has a goal for the company to have network connectivity across 90% of our products, which means that we'll have connectivity across hi-fi systems and cameras and phones. Even in here, we're demonstrating the connectivity from one of the new Sony Ericsson phones, where you can actually, it supports DLNA, it has Wi-Fi built in, so you can actually stream your content off your phone straight to your TV as well.
So there you go. Sony's got big plans when it comes to connecting up your lounge room. Now, regardless of Sony's claims, I'm sure you'll only get the best interoperability by using all Sony gear. That's okay, other vendors are the same. I've come to the conclusion that if you want a good digital home user experience, you need to pledge your allegiance to one vendor. I've decided to go down the Apple path, while my mate Al has decided to go down the Sony path. I'm building my lounge room around a Mac Mini, admittedly plugged into a Sony Bravia, while my mate Al is building his lounge room around a PlayStation 3. We're competing for the glory, to see who can offer the best integrated digital lounge room and rub the other's nose in it. He doesn't know that yet. Maybe I should warn him. I have to admit that what I saw at Uchi has me worried. A home entertainment system built around a PlayStation 3 is looking more attractive than ever, especially once we see the Play TV television tuner come out later in the year. Meanwhile, I'm trying to cobble together something with an Apple solution. Apple TV just doesn't cut it. You have to hack the bejesus out of it before it does anything you want. If Steve Jobs doesn't pull a proper multimedia hub out of his back pocket soon in an "oh, and one more thing" moment, Apple is in danger of missing the boat in the digital lounge room. Of course, Apple would prefer you to source all your entertainment from the iTunes store, so it may never happen. I have to admit it, when it comes to the digital lounge room, Sony's got it going on. Just don't tell my mate Al.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
That was a very thin Adam Turner there on his PC microphone, I think. Something like that. Very interesting stuff.
DLNA. Sony. I like the sound of it. As
yeah,
long as
still can't work out how an acronym just doesn't quite... DLNA, they could have thought of something better.
DLNA. I'm cautiously optimistic. As long as it's an open standard which can talk to devices that aren't manufactured by Sony.
But that's the thing. Yeah, well, that's the alliance. The alliance allegedly
hopefully,
has
that's right,
a lot of members.
That's right. And hopefully the alliance will achieve that by having lots of different manufacturers collaborating.
But this is what I've been waiting for. Personally, in my multimedia world, I wanted a television set which had direct connection to the internet via your network.
Yep.
And the biggest selling point for me is for being able to watch our television programs on demand, as you would expect to do in this day and age, with video libraries now starting to emerge online. Not quite yet in Australia, but it will happen in our lifetime. We'll get to see some movies via the internet, streamed, good quality. But more importantly, the ABC, the trendsetters in this country for technology, are doing it here and now with their iView. So if anyone hasn't experienced iView yet, it's a video on demand service where you can go and basically watch anything that's been on ABC television. They're growing their service, so it gets better and better each day. You can watch it live to your PC or your laptop, and it's better than VHS quality, and it's probably not quite as good as DVD quality, but nonetheless, very smooth and very watchable. And if you plug that into your Bravia television set and surf to the AVC's iTunes site, you can watch anything you want by just a click of a mouse. Make sure you're on a ISP, which gives you free access to iView, because that's...
Or you've got a plan that can
support
it. Or a
big band, yeah. Big plan, yeah.
Now, iView will only work if you've got ADSL 2 and it's running at a nice high speed, or if you've got cable or something really fast, yeah.
Yes, the faster your internet connection, the better it is.
And the whole point of the DLNA, the Digital Living Networking Alliance, what is that right, whatever it is?
Yeah, that's right. See, it just doesn't gel. It doesn't roll off the tongue.
But the whole point of that is that you won't have to plug anything into your television to watch something on iView.
Wireless would be good.
All you need to do is plug in a
211N. It does support that.
Network cable. You won't need to actually...
I was looking at specs, and there are some in the DLNA. If you go and have a look on Sony.net, in their technology section, you can see the specs there for DLNA. That's Sony.net, Sony Info and Technology. Just go and have a browse there. There are specs there for the DLNA circuit, and there is some 802.11xx support there as well. So maybe you may not need the blue cable after all. Maybe you can just wirelessly pop in, which I think would be terrific.
That'd be great. As long as the wireless is fast enough, can do what we need it to do.
Yes. So Ethernet and the toaster, I think that's not far off. And as some of our people on the chat have been inferring tonight, Ethernet in other areas of the house could also be beneficial. All right. Google, the world's largest search engine, the juggernaut. Everyone uses it. Everyone knows it. They have a couple of guys working for them. One's name is Nathan Jones. Now, he's a Google search quality analyst. The other chap is an Indo... Now, please excuse me if I don't... I'm not very good with some of these names. And it's Makajay, I think.
Makajay, I think that's a good attempt.
An Indo, I hope that's okay. An Indo Makajay. He's a software engineer also for search over there in Mountain View. And what we're going to talk about, or what Lid went down to discuss, is any of the new trends that are coming up in search. Especially if you're into social networking, if you do blogs and you do web pages and you want to link to other people's pages, how does that affect your site? One of the interesting things that I got out of it was the fact that Google now places emphasis on the neighborhood that you hang out in. Know what I mean?
Like what other sites are
what you link
from
to,
and, link to.
And, the,
yeah.
and the reputation of those sites. So if you're, hanging out in an area where you're of ill repute or of extreme, you know, well-being and good relations and stuff, your site will be tarnished or will have effect, I guess, from those sites too. So anyway, Lid went down there and had a bit of a chat, so we'll have a little listen about 10 minutes or thereabouts of having a chat with these guys about the latest trends and what's going on in search. So here's Lid in California.
But for Google Webmaster Central and the guidelines, are there any additional resources or recommendations for bloggers trying to do the right thing by search engines in terms of optimization specifically?
So there are actually a number of resources. To start with, we have a number of blogs that you go to. For example, Matt Gutz has a blog in which he has a lot of resources and things done up and new things which are coming out. You have a lot of information there. Other than that, there are a number of other blogs which you can also go to, like external blogs which have a lot of other resources. We try to keep the Webmaster blog as updated as possible.
Yeah, and really there's a ton of information there. When you say Webmaster Central, we're talking about, we have a huge help center for support and questions. We've got the Webmaster Central blog, we've got the groups, and we've got a lot of Googlers that are on there trying to answer a lot of questions, and super users, which are just, you know, anybody can join the group and talk on it. We've got a handful of super users that answer a lot of questions, so we try to foster a lot of community involvement in the groups. And we've got some other blogs too, like there's a few blogs and resources that we recommend for information, like Pro Blogger, Copy Blogger, there's the Search Marketing Expo, SMX for short, there's the Search Engine Strategies Conferences, and Danny Sullivan's got the Search Engine Land resource as well. So those are just a few things for people to use.
So is there a difference between optimizing for a static website and for a blog?
So essentially, there are some basic differences between a normal website, a static website, and a blog. To begin with, the blog website has contents coming in from user. And so it is not necessarily entirely trustworthy at all times. So you need to take some measures there in order to make sure that the content that is coming in from external users is what you intend it to be. You don't want malicious content or linking to bad neighborhoods and things like that. So that is the first thing. The second thing is that in a blog, if you're having feeds and if you have other kinds of blog-specific things, then you should make sure that it is what the users want. So besides these two, there is no real difference between the way we treat the ranking or we try to see how the ranking is actually behaving.
I think it's a good rule of thumb to just treat your blog as you would your website in SEO terms, really. There are some aspects to a blog that are CMS, content management system type of things, like blog comments and guest books and stuff like that, where visitors can come and interact with the blog or leave a comment and that type of thing.
I'm just thinking about elements on a homepage where you have a full post versus a partial post. Does that make any difference?
We've mostly seen that users like to have to see full posts as opposed to partial posts. Although from a Google standpoint, we don't make any difference or differentiation between these two. Although it's a good idea to have stuff which users like, which is mostly a full post is something which would please the users more than a partial post.
What about how many posts on a page? Does that make any difference?
I think it's more of a user experience thing. Same thing with the previous question, full or partial posts. Personally, I use a feed reader, and I usually end up unsubscribing from blogs that do partial posts. But that's just my personal experience. And I think generally you want to foster like a long-term relationship with your readers, and that's using full posts is a good idea and a good step in that direction. Same thing with how many posts you want to put on your homepage. I mean, if you're posting like 20 posts a day and it takes forever for the blog to load for the user, probably bad user experience. So
with categories, someone had mentioned that if you post to, say, three different categories and that repeats the page over and over, do you guys see that as duplicate content?
Having the same post in multiple categories is fine, as long as the categories are relevant. So if you have the same post in 3 to 5 categories, let's say, that's a good thing, probably because you can have several meanings to the same post. But if you listed in all categories possible, then that's something that may not be useful to the users, as well as something which is not relevant. So essentially, it all boils down to what the users would like to see there.
Does the number of external links from a homepage matter?
We recommend about 100, less than 100 links per page. If you have a lot more links, then it just gets a lot cluttered.
What about archive pages? Are there any best practices?
I think that's kind of another matter of preference. You can choose not to have any links to your archive posts at all. I know some blogs do that, but it's usually pretty handy, I think. I mean, as a user myself, I like to see maybe a monthly list of archives on the side somewhere, and I think that's pretty handy.
How important is metadata, title, description, keywords on a blog?
Metadata is fairly important. You know, when you're talking about things like your title, tags, those are important. Meta description is important. You know, sometimes we use the meta description as the content for the snippet when we think it's, you know, the best use. And meta keywords, I don't think are as useful nearly as much these days as they used to be. But yeah, title tags and meta descriptions are definitely useful. And the more targeted, the more descriptive you can be with the title and the meta descriptions, the better it is for the user and the better it is for search engines.
Duplicate content. Is that something that you guys can work out, or is it something that webmaster needs to work out?
Duplicate content, if you have multiple versions of a page on your site, Google does a pretty good job at figuring out which version it thinks you want to serve up to the users. There are certain situations where sometimes, you'll get scraped. There's a couple of different things you can do to take care of that. The first thing you can do is file what's called a DMCA request. You can do a search for DMCA if you don't know too much about it. It stands for Digital Millennium Copyright Act. That's one way you can take care of it. The second thing you can do is if you think that site is spamming, you can submit a spam report via the Google Webmaster Console.
Yeah, and also if you can use your sitemaps to your advantage and list the page which you want to be shown for that particular query. So if you have duplicate content on your site, it's very helpful to have to tell us that which is the page that you really want. So I'd say it's the responsibility of Google as well as the webmaster to make sure that the duplicate content is resolved properly.
And we just had Susan Moskow post on the Google Webmaster Central blog not too long ago about, it was titled Demystifying Duplicate Content, So if, I think if you can either go to the blog, it's a long URL, I'm going to spell it out, but if you search Google for demystifying duplicate content, it should pop up number one. And that's a pretty informative post.
Talking about spam, can you define blogs being scraper sites?
Blogs are essentially blogs which are spammy, by which we mean that they are either linking to other blatant spammy sites, for example, sites which have no added value and which are basically there to just capitalize on the AdSense or some money or other affiliate programs. Pings are essentially phenomena which are basically spammy pings. So if I have a blog, I may have a ping which will go out 100 times a second just to tell others that I have a post. So that whereas I don't have a post. So that is basically something which is, again, a spammy technique which people use. Scraper sites are essentially sites which try to go and scrape content from other legitimate sites and put them as their own. Oftentimes, these are accompanied by other links for monetary purposes, basically.
Actually, I have to ask about this because this just happened to me recently. And what someone did was take a page, recreate the page on a different domain, and put a big ad across the top of it. But the page is exactly the same. It's copied directly.
It's a pretty common tactic, especially for scrapers. They usually have two motives. One motive is to make money, and that's just, and they need content, right? So they scrape your content word for word, and then they slap up some sort of affiliate money-making program on the page, and then hope that they get clicks on those ads. The other thing that they're trying to do is if they're not monetizing that page, they're just trying to build up some page rank so that they can flow that page rank to some other website.
How many scraper sites do you estimate are out there?
It's very difficult to say how many sites there are because, first of all, the index is really huge and that we also don't cover the entire world. But we try to do a very good job of catching whatever scraping sites there are. We have evolved algorithms over the years, and now I think we are at a stage where we can pretty much say which site is the original site and which site is the scraped site.
Yeah, and we do a really good job at automatically detecting a lot of the scraper sites. I mean, we have lots of signals that we look at, and we can slice and dice the language on a page, words and phrases, and we have lots of different ways of figuring out which ones are the scrapers.
How do you determine, how does a webmaster determine whether they're linking to a bad neighborhood?
So the webmaster needs to be careful as to where he or she is linking to. So if, for example, I own a blog, I should be very careful about what are the comments that are coming in, what are the people who are coming into Facebook. And it'll be great if I can monitor those and see whether spammy comments or spammy posts or links to bad neighborhoods have really come in. If they cannot do that, and if they see some decrease in their site's ranking which they think can be attributed with their being classified as being in a bad neighborhood, it's certainly okay for them to send us a request and say that a re-inclusion request. And the other thing is that if the site gets hacked, so oftentimes we see that there are legitimate sites which get hacked, spammers go into it and they put links to some other known spammy clusters. And that happens quite often. We try to detect that, again, algorithmically as much as possible. But if the webmaster knows about it and can tell us, that it's really good for us.
Are there any tools available to check whether you are considered a bad neighborhood?
So one of the things that you can do is to see if your ranking has gone down using all the tools that Google has. For example, you can go to Analytics and see if your rankings have gone down steadily over time or if there has been a certain hit in your ranking. So, for example, if you're ranking high for a certain set of queries and suddenly those rankings went down, then it means that something weird has happened during that time. Either you have linked to something bad or your content has gotten spammy or something of that sort. So if you see certain such things, it's probably time to stop and consider what's really going on your site.
So you can log into the Google Webmaster Console and we'll show you different things. Sometimes we'll send you a notification if, let's say, we found out that your blog got hacked. Let's say like there's some hidden links on your blog or something. We'll notify you via Google Webmaster Console. Or if you were caught hiding links or something like that. So there's a lot of other resources inside the console that you can check out. As a webmaster, we'll show you like the particular terms that your queries that you're showing up for in Google and what position. And if you log into the console, you can also see number of backlinks you have and where they're coming from and stuff like that.
How important are tags, tagging content?
I think tags are pretty useful. Recently, I came across a site, it was a chess site basically, and events were listed as they occurred. And there were a lot of other events, but I was interested in this particular tournament. and that was listed as a tag. So clicking on that, I got all the points. So if the tag is very relevant and if it clearly has some added content value, then it is good. Oftentimes, sites also have tags just for the sake of having tags and just for trying to rank higher. And that is something which we strongly discourage. If you're adding tags just for the sake of adding tags, then that is not a good thing.
Guidelines when you're tagging.
I think one thing you would be careful is you don't want to defeat the purpose of using tags by using too many. I mean, if you put like 100 tags on something, you're kind of defeating the purpose of applying a tag to that, similar to categories.
Nofollow. Can you tell me a little bit about nofollow and what that means?
Nofollow, before there was the nofollow tag for a link attribute, the only way to tell Googlebot not to follow a link was to tell Googlebot not to follow an entire page. And that was done using the nofollow meta tag. So it was something that a lot of webmasters wanted. They wanted to have that granularity over not following a particular link instead of not following an entire page. So basically, it gives a webmaster a little more control over which links they don't want Googlebot to follow and crawl.
Why would someone not want a link followed?
There's a couple reasons. It's important also to know that using the rel equals nofollow means Googlebot won't crawl it, so that means PageRank won't flow. There's a few instances where you might want to use the nofollow tag, and one of them is when you're talking about content that you don't trust as a webmaster. So if there's a link on your website or your blog, and you can't vouch for that content on the other side, then it might be a good idea to use the nofollow tag.
A lot of sites have too many nofollows. It's good and bad. It's good because, for example, places like Wikipedia, where there are a lot of links going out, but Wikipedia need not always trust what these links are linking to, or blogs, which need not always trust what these what the comments are linking to. So there, using nofollow is a good idea. What happens is that oftentimes webmasters think that they can use nofollow to shape their page rank or engineer how the page rank is flowing inside the site.
Is that what people are now calling sculpting?
Page rank sculpting,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And that is something that we strongly discourage, because that is not the intention of nofollow. Nofollow is meant for something which is completely different.
What about advertising when you're linking to an advertisement? Should it be used then?
Three main reasons why you want to use nofollow, and the third one would be when you're talking about paid links. Just like in any other advertising medium, it's important for disclosure. There's a couple different ways that you can take care of that. One is using the rel equals nofollow attribute. And there's other ways you can do it, like you can send your text links through a redirect that is robots.textedout, prevents Googlebot from crawling it. That's another way to do it. But rel equals nofollow is an easier way for implementing that.
I think the bottom line is that whatever is good for the users is something that webmasters should do, because in the long run, that is what is going to help.
Focus on creating unique and compelling content, and then get relevant links from trusted sources. And those are a couple of the most important things you can do, whether you have a blog or a website.
One more thing, paid links. They're okay to have?
Paid links with the sole purpose of manipulating the Google search results is not okay. And that is against the terms of service.
So often what happens is that people who really buy links, they're buying links just to get some ranking improvement and things like that done. So essentially what we want is that if a page is ranking, it should rank because it has good content, not because it has bought links from other places. And that is the general philosophy that we have. And hence, we try to dissuade that if we see pages with no content ranking just paid links.
Anindo and Nathan, thank you for talking with us.
Sure.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Compelling.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Judicious.
The question is really whether young people particularly are addicted to being connected to other people all the time.
Historical.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history. This is the day, the 6th of October, 2006, that life in Australia will be changed forever.
caring.
I know as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school. How can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
You heard of road rage? What about web rage?
They should be wearing a mask and carrying a gun.
Relations between Telstra and the federal government have been extremely strained almost from the moment Sol Trujillo became chief executive.
Optus have again had quite a good quarter, but its 3G service is very low profile at the moment.
And the Queen's got an iPod.
Betty's got one.
Yeah.
Wonder what she listens to. She'll probably listen to us.
An unexpectedly high number of voters swamped the system. Well, what did they expect?
Controversial.
Less attention is paid to the equally interesting question, should journalists blog?
Magical.
And I've got some residual powers.
Ambitious.
High-speed broadband, it's available in most of Asia as well as being in the rest of the world. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
Religion.
Talking of the Roman Catholics, I have been on Vatican Radio.
Comedy.
You put the date on ePray, it goes blah, 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 and you get a whole service. Just on.
How does it go?
It goes blah, 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 blah.
Insightful, entertaining, and informative. Tech Talk Radio. More than just technology.
It's a strictly rehearsed and finely polished program.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the panel. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. Dr. Ron and Graham Callaghan are in this evening for our 199th show for the series so far. How long do you reckon we'll go for?
We haven't done that many, surely.
Yeah, 199. Start off in, what, 2004? Yeah,
wow.
Life's like that. And here we are again. We're talking about Google a lot tonight. That was very interesting. Thank you, Lyd, for doing that. Quick question. Do you know what a splog is now?
A splog, a spammy blog.
Yeah.
That was my understanding of the explanation.
Mm. Pretty good at it.
So someone who's deliberately scraping other blogs and putting content up online just purely to get...
traffic.
Link cred.
Yes. I don't know. What people go to, I think, these days is amazing. But I guess that's why they redo their indexing and algorithms frequently so that at least those that... trying to cheat the system don't get too much of a handle on it.
That's good.
Which I think is excellent. So
it's good that they're looking at it all the time. It's a constantly evolving beast, that algorithm.
And they're coming up into their 10th anniversary. They've been around for 10 years. Now, I've got some numbers here that might just interest you about Google and their 10 years. Obviously, we know about Google, G-O-O-G-O-L, a mathematical term for the figure 1, followed by 100 zeros.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, I won't bore you with that. Another interesting number, 4. Is the number of people in the company when it started in a garage in Menlo Park in California in September 1998.
Isn't
it started
that amazing?
Off 4 in a garage, yeah. 70 to 30 is the ratio of male to female employees.
Yeah.
19,604 is the number of Googlers or employees worldwide.
19,000?
Yep, that's the payroll.
Wow.
60% is the proportion of the worldwide internet searches made on Google. So they haven't got up to 90 yet.
60%?
Yeah.
I'm surprised it's that low.
Yes, it is a bit surprising.
What
is that low,
isn't
it?
What was the figure again? The proportion?
Proportion of worldwide internet searches made on Google.
Oh, right. Mm. Right. So probably MSNs that have a large...
Just by default because they're the default web page, yeah.
Yep. When they deploy their web browser, it starts up on their web page, yeah.
Mm. £0. $0, free, whatever currency you'd like to point in.
Poundage.
Is the amount it costs Google staff to eat. So they get free food in the cafe.
Free food. That's a good deal.
I reckon so. $157 billion. That's Google's current market
average
value.
Average salary of a Google employee.
No. No. If you want to buy it, that's what you're up for.
Okay. So $157 billion.
That's right. Hmm. 40%. Is the proportion of online advertising controlled by Google. That's pretty massive.
Huge, isn't it?
Absolutely. No wonder they're worth $157 billion. One day per week is the Google engineers are expected to spend on other projects that interest them in company time. And that's good. I don't know whether it has to be IT related or what, but they can go off and play golf one day a week if that's what interests them.
That's great. Isn't that great?
I think so. 112 is the number of languages Google speaks, allowing users to set their homepage to Latin and, of course, Klingon.
Yes, that's right. Yes, of course.
They have a few odd languages in there, if I remember correctly.
So wonder if they have Jedi yet, because we've got that over here as a political religion, haven't we?
Yeah, Jedi is more a religion, isn't it, than a language. But interesting. Graham's looking up the Klingon
and my last
Google page, I think.
My last Klingon number. My last Google number. 1 million. That's the excuse me, that's the number of CVs sent to Google every year from would be employees.
1 million.
There you go. Pretty impressive numbers, isn't it? For a company that's turning 10 years old. That came from the guardian.co.uk.
There you go.
Pretty amazing. What's that, Graham? You found Klingon on your desktop now, haven't you?
I found the list of Google interface languages, the number of different languages you can have the Google interface in. And I think my favourite on the list has to be the Bork 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 language, which is the Swedish chef language.
There's a Bork 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 language.
Yeah.
How did you find that list, Graham? What did you do? Is it an easy address to read out?
The Swedish chef. Yeah. That was from the Muppets, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
www.google.com/language_tools.
Great. Google. So what does it do? So it changes your whole desktop to Bork Bork Bork.
It'll change the Google interface language. So it'll yeah.
So how does it ask what you want to search for in Bork Bork Bork? Realise there's people listening to us now going and doing exactly what you're doing.
Yeah.
And they'll switch to a language. It's like when your mobile phone goes to French. Or Spanish.
You've just got to remember how
and
to...
And you can't put it back.
You've got to remember how to put it back. You've got to remember the keystrokes, don't you, to get it back to the
It's not like
right
when you
language.
Change your monitor setting in Windows where it goes, just don't do anything for 15 seconds and it comes back to what last was. This is serious stuff. You have to do a software reboot here, so hopefully it's not the same on Google.
No. It's quite easy to find your way around. And, yeah, you can quite clearly see that, Lunguegia... Tools is going to get you back to language tools.
I'm glad. Better his PC than mine. Vint Cerf, he's one of the old Google heads, really. Chief evangelist of Google, to be quite precise.
Yep.
Set out his views on the internet's future to coincide with the 10th birthday of the Big G. And he said on his blog, 10 years... Around 70% of the human population will have fixed or mobile access to the internet at increasingly high speeds, up to gigabits per second. He left a bit out about Australia.
In 10 years?
In the next 10 years, we will have up to gigabits per second data rates on mobile broadband. The man often referred to as the father of the internet, moved to the next generation IP accessing scheme, IP6, and GPS, enablement of household consumer devices. So we're starting to see a lot of that now. Many of the things on the internet, whether mobile or fixed, we'll know where they are both geographically and logically. That's good too, hence the Google mapping sort of stuff. The one which I found quite interesting is Cerf does not, however, mention bandwidth worries over internet capacity and the rapid depletion of IP addresses. We spoke about this recently, didn't we, Dr. Ron? You didn't think it was too much to worry about IP4s and IP6s. Was that you? Were we talking about that?
It might have been me. This was the... What we're talking about here is the address system that computers use on the internet to communicate.
The individual phone number-y thing for a computer.
IPv4 addresses, which are the ones we're using now, have been in short supply for a very long time now.
Version 4 addresses.
Yeah, these are the, 203.
But how short are we?
Whatever.
How short are we?
Well, this is just the thing. We're starting to talk about introducing a new system to cater for the dwindling number of version 4 addresses, people started using network address translation.
That's right. They're so short that network address translation is now virtually universal. Everybody has to use it.
Well, if you connect to the mobile on Telstra through NextG, you'll get an internal network address.
That's right. Yep, and the same with a lot of those sorts of networks.
What this means with network address translation is that if you have your own network which you operate, or maintain, you can assign your own numbering plan or your own internet address within your network.
And the next person across can then reuse those same addresses because they're not addresses
that are usable on the
public network. That's right.
If you think of it as a phone system in your office, you might have extension 100, an extension 101, an extension 102. If you dial extension 103, it's going to ring in your office. It's not going to ring on extension 103 in the office across the road.
That's right.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And you can't use those extension numbers out in the real phone
network.
That's
right. They may not actually mean anything to...
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it's like.
So now we've started introducing this network address translation is being used everywhere by private networks.
Yeah.
It's sort of taken the pressure off the the need to implement IP version 6.
But only to some degree.
Do you think it's still going to have to happen, Graham?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm. Yeah.
Everyone who has more than one computer at home, I would say there'd be a 90% chance that they're actually doing exactly what you just said. They'll be given their little router that connects them to the internet.
Yeah, all those little routers do exactly that.
We'll give the computers on their side of the firewall its own unique IP address, which is just theirs for that internal network, extension number 103, as you say.
It's what computer boffins call a non-routable address. It means that it's only usable on a private network, and it can't actually ever find its way onto...
across the public network.
Into the public network. And if it did, it would just be ignored.
It would.
The traffic just wouldn't go anywhere.
Now, the boys on the chat are talking about this already, but this leads into China. They've got a big problem. They're running out of IP addresses. Chinese officials are calling for a mass migration to IP6 after disclosing that they've only got 830 days of IP4 left. My goodness.
Warlock's suggestion is to NAT the whole country.
Yes, have your own network. Good idea.
Yes, network address translation at the Great Firewall of China.
Well, it
was going to work anywhere in the world that would work in China.
That's right. It's the one place where you could do
it. The government just controls everything.
Can we send Sol and his mates over there?
Oh, yes, please. They'll send them up there behind the Great Firewall with everybody else. Yeah, best place for them. Go on.
Absolutely. Anyway, at a conference, it was said by Mr. Li Kai that the changeover to IP6 must come soon, otherwise internet users in China would start to face problems getting online.
Mm.
That's I don't know, is this a bit like water in Australia? Is this IP addresses in China?
Well, even though everybody does do the network address translation, the router device that does the translation, it still needs, even if it's got 100 PCs inside it, that point of connection to the main internet does need a real, genuine, bona fide IP address. So, the more people you connect online, the less addresses you've got, and the more it's going to start to become short supply. So, yep, it's probably a good thing. If this is happening in China and the pressure's really on, then that will improve the support for IPv6 in general, with a bit of luck. More software will start to support it. More ISPs will start to understand what it is and start to support it. And it might sort of be that tipping point that starts to bring IPv6, which has been around for a while, as sort of an enthusiast. People know it's.
Is it backward compatible? Like, can you mix mash your IPs, or is one is like you can?
Yes, because there's within IPv6, there's a special prefix that. Matches the old IPv4 networks.
So it recognises a packet of data as
coming from... Yeah, so to convert all of IP4 into one little subnet of IPv6, you just put this one prefix on the front of it.
And that's what will ultimately happen, what has happened, and what will slowly become the norm.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, let's go from the sublime to the ridiculous, where they can't get enough IP addresses to a place where they can't get any internet at all. Basslink, Tassie. Oh. Our Tasmanian listeners, there's been a recent debacle where they can't get high-speed broadband due to capacity issues between the bit of cable or fibre optic that runs between the mainland and Tasmania. Anyway, the Basslink resolution is getting closer. Basslink Cable over City Spring this week said negotiations to switch on the undersea's fibre optic cable to Tasmania were close to concluding, bringing hopes of increased broadband capacity to the island state, which I hope happens sooner or later. Because what happens, there's the power company that run a fibre optic cable alongside their power lines that go under the under Bass Strait.
And when they dropped the power cable, it had some fibre bundled in with
right.
it.
They need an Austel permit or something. So they can do this. And once they get their ticket from the ACMA to say they can be a telecommunications provider, not to mention electricity, then they can open it up. And hopefully that'll make the Tasmanians can get a bit more grunt for their, rather than 56K speeds.
Yeah, a little bit of competition instead of Telstra running the only link between the mainland and, Taswegia.
Yes, exactly. We might take a break. We'll come back and we'll talk more about some other things that are on the rundown. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb, Dr. Ron and Graham Callaghan. Back with more in a moment.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Do no evil Google sued for $1 billion.
Is it a job for government though, or is it a job for ISPs to provide interlinks?
Hey, yeah, nerd alert. What?
The thing is, people put it on vibrate or silent and you can't tell.
Which is which? What do you mean, which is which?
You can't vote with your feet because there are no other options.
Oh, did I say that?
Yeah, you might have.
12 megabits though.
Entertaining.
What's the problem, Dr. Ron?
Informative.
Has it got a network port on the back?
Independent.
Do they do that in some
Absolutely
other countries?
They do.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
No.
She tells me.
Keeps your knees warm, doesn't it?
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you. You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back, Andrew McComb, Graham Callaghan, Dr. Ron. Whatever happened to Senator Helen Coonan? I heard her in a promo before, and we were just contemplating that.
She did.
Yeah, I know. She did lose an election.
Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs, off the top of my head.
Oh, she got a promotion, did she?
Something.
She might know something about that.
Sure, we'll have
she got a promotion with a demotion.
Yeah, we'll have to Google her.
Absolutely. Anyway.
No one cares.
Really?
Well,
it sounded like you just said no one cares then.
I did.
You're a little off mic at the time. Oh, you did. Okay.
Okay.
Just wanted to clarify that.
Excellent. All right. Experts are warning of a new PDF attack for everyone who uses portable document files, which are of the Adobe flavor. Security organizations are warning users to be vigilant following the discovery of two new crop tools.
Mm.
I've never cropped in PDF before, but nonetheless.
Be alert, not alarmed.
The US Computer Emergency Response Team, USERT, and Secure Computing issued alerts after several exploit tools were found to make the rounding. Sorry, they were doing the rounds in cyber criminals, which is good, I guess. They must send PDFs to try and execute code on your device. But the toolkits are especially dangerous due to their ability to avoid security systems. The latest attacks catalog infected users and refrain from sending attacks more than once, making it more difficult for security vendors to track down the source of the attacks. In addition, the new tools researchers, that's the word I'm trying to say. Thank you, Graham. Have also found PDF exploits common, and components are being added on to existing attacks for other systems down the track. So,
moral of the story, when you're looking in your email, PDF files are not necessarily safe. If they've come from somebody or you're not expecting them, then probably best not to open them.
Yeah, and there's a lot of them out there doing the rounds, especially people, as you say, people that you don't know.
Yep.
Don't open them. Like,
also,
you know,
go and update your PDF reading software, which is probably Adobe Reader.
Yes. Yes.
Go to adobe.com and get the latest version.
Exactly. Now, something that you're all probably really keen to do is go and get yourself a free copy of Windows 7.
Yeah.
Why would you?
Well, because it couldn't be worse than Vista, could it?
Well, I don't know. That's a gutsy call there, Graham.
Windows 7 is the next operating system to be released by Microsoft.
Yeah, Windows Vista ME has been put out to pasture and they're now working on Windows 7.
Hopefully it'll be an improvement.
Yeah, the catch.
Some positive spin here.
Oh, yes, we should. We're being very cynical, but...
is there going to be a code name for it?
I don't know. Probably. They have one for everything else. What's the latest ski field that he hasn't been to for a while or something?
Yeah, that's right.
They pick funny little ski fields in United States somewhere?
They're just calling it Windows 7 for now.
Anyway, what Microsoft are doing is they've confirmed that they'll be giving away free copies of Windows 7 in October. And there is a catch, of course. One of the catches, it's what they call a pre-beta version.
Alpha version.
Or as David Winder says, who writes for IT Wire, a version that should not go near any PC that you wish to use for any other purposes than to have a look at Windows 7.
So because it's not a finished product, of course, it's going to have some problems. It's not necessarily going to work in every situation. So.
No, I have seen some screenshots of what it looks like, and it does look similarly like Vista, if that's actually a word.
That's probably
similar to Vista.
That's probably not a surprise.
No.
As long as it works better.
But anyway, if you're attending a conference in the United States, the Microsoft Professional Developer Conference, to be precise, in Los Angeles, at the end of October, then you'll get a copy.
Oh, okay. So you've got to fly over
there
to
is that
the
other
US
catch.
And,
yeah, there's always catches.
And attend the conference.
But nonetheless, I guess the whole purpose of it is to see that Microsoft are actually starting to bring out working versions of their new operating system, which
there's been a lot of buzz about, a lot of talk about it. Microsoft have obviously been keen to start getting the word out that there is something coming, that Vista's not the the end of the line, that there's perhaps something to look forward to afterwards. So, yeah, perhaps this is a sign of things to come, and at more Microsoft events that they'll start getting a little bit more of this code out there so that some of us in the business can try it out.
Absolutely. Warlock has answered your question there, Dr. Ron, formerly codenamed Blackcomb and later Vienna.
Ah, yeah, I've heard of Vienna.
Have you?
Thanks, Warlock.
Yeah. Server 2008 is supposed to be brilliant for desktops. It is. I've got Server 2008. I've loaded it up as a desktop. It works really well. Anyway, we won't go there. That's time. That's for another story. So, anyway. All right. The other interesting bit of news, too, Internode, which is South Australia's premier ISP, who is slowly taking over the world, has announced the availability of Ironport spam and virus filter technology as a service for its small and medium-sized businesses.
Good.
Because let me tell you, the amount of spam that's coming through these days is getting... It just gets worse and worse.
It does. Well, your ISPs should be providing anti-spam and anti-virus software on their servers free of charge as a matter of course. It's something they should just have in place and should have working for
you. And there is really good software that you can run yourself if you're running your own mail server as well.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
I must admit, I like Kaspersky's anti-spammy stuff.
Do you?
It learns as you go along. So the longer you use it, the better it gets.
I've started using Kaspersky on my Windows desktops. And I've got to say, getting a bit warning fatigued by Kaspersky. What I mean by that is that it's always alerting and always popping up and telling me about things. Things are trying to,
configure it so that it doesn't harass you.
Maybe
like that.
I need to dumb it down a bit because it drives me crazy. Whereas I used to have a product there. I used to use Webroot Spy Sweeper, I think, from anti-spyware.
How's the pig going at 2 in the morning? That gives us a shocker,
Yeah, I don't hear the pig usually, but it always dings and tells me that something's run, and about to run. And I think, well, I know, I just told something to run. It's okay, just get over it.
Yeah, you can turn those notifications off. Yeah, you just have to spend the time and go into the control panel and do that.
I'm getting concerned that I'm just going to click allow one day, and I'm going to let something through that maybe I shouldn't. Warning fatigue is a real problem.
It is. It's a difficult balancing act to know, how often to warn and how often not to warn. Obviously, if you go too far the other way, then things, can accidentally get run without being asked, from being launched from web pages and things like that. And this is how your machine becomes spyware infected and becomes a zombie and contributes to the spam problem that we're all suffering from. So,
we're all trying to fix in the first place.
Exactly right.
Yes. Look at the time, gentlemen. Back with the last bit of the show after this.
You're listening.
Dr. Ron?
Here I am listening.
Residual powers. And I've got some residual powers.
You can't turn off CDMA.
In terms of the volume,
I understand.
To give fingerprints. Now,
we may have digressed.
Talk radio.
Phil Burgess also claimed the country would remain behind.
We used to think 600 kilometers per second was good.
Don't open things that you're not expecting, even if they do look like it.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics.
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Perfect for anyone who's got multiple high-definition screens. This would be for someone who's...
Dr. Ron.
Yeah, who may be using them for promotional purposes in a business or in a show or something like that. Geffen have got a 1-to-5 splitter for HDMI running over Cat 5.
Well, that's handy. That means you can plug one of your HDMIs out of your Blu-ray or whatever.
Yep, the output of your Blu-ray disc player or whatever it might happen to be, any HDMI source, and you can split it over 5 different Cat 5 outputs, run it as much as 45 metres to, if you want full... high quality video, or even further if you can step down to something like 1080i instead of 1080p, Run up to 45 metres away, decode it straight onto the, your plasma panel or whatever it might happen to be. Perfect first, you know, if you want to have the same source showing on multiple screens around your shop.
Schools.
Or exactly right.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Anything like that. Great
Perfect.
Idea.
Yeah.
Haven't seen too many of those out, so that's probably the first of many, no doubt. Got a price on it, or is it just a prototype?
Look, it's not cheap. It's
HDMI, isn't it?
Yeah, it's HDMI and it's high def, so $2,249.
Oh, it's not too bad.
But it's compatible
speaking.
With virtually every HDMI device that's around. And if that's the sort of thing you do, if you're promoting things on multiple screens, this is the way to go. It's got to be cheaper than buying multiple Blu-ray players.
Absolutely.
It's what the large retailers need to do in their showrooms when they've got four or five or six or a dozen
Absolutely.
Monitors
Instead
on display.
Of the dreadful, shocking pictures they put on them these days.
Off-air, snowy grunge that you so often see. You
exactly
need something
right.
like this.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
The website of the week this week is not really technically related. In fact, it's just something to amuse you. I had a look at it during the course of the week. If you're into computer games, you'll like it. Lydia Davis put me onto this site. I had a bit of a chuckle about it. But
it's a YouTube video, you told me.
If you're sitting there, you go to YouTube, www.youtube.com/experiencewii, as in the WII, the PlayStation sort of equivalent, you know, game console-y thing. So you'll be very interested. Have a look at it on your desktop and its surrounding desktop, what happens.
Watch it to the end.
Watch it all the way to the end. Hopefully it won't buffer in cache because otherwise it loses a bit. But the website of the week is really just a bit of an amusement this week. All the W's at youtube.com/experiencewii. And hopefully you won't be disappointed.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
Showtime. Missed it by that much.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
RIM.
RIM.
RIM. Research in Motion. It's a company that makes a little device called a BlackBerry.
Oh, yes.
How much would you expect to pay for a BlackBerry?
Oh, I don't know, outright, maybe $400 or $500.
There's a new model that Research in Motion are about to release called the 8900 Javelin, 8900 Javelin model. Not yet released by RIM, but someone put one up for sale on eBay. And this not yet released BlackBerry sold
fully working,
on
hope.
eBay, fully working, fully operational, for $17,100.
Gee, Crikey. What does it do? The
eBay user J Davidson 31 is the lucky winner of this BlackBerry 8900 Javelin that ended this morning. Why would anyone pay this amount to get a BlackBerry Javelin is beyond us. Maybe it's a competitor that can't wait to get their hands on it, or maybe someone just has too much money. For that price, J Davidson 31 gets a free car charger, but he or she still has to pay $30 shipping.
Great. You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio. What a lovely surprise that would have been. 17,000. I reckon it was mistyped, don't you?
I don't know.
Put
I don't
in 17,000
so.
Hits submit. Whoops, a daisy.
Oh, I hope not for their part.
All right. Don't forget, come and join us for our 200th show next week on the station you're listening to now. In fact, come and join us live on the stream if you get a chance to at chat.techtalkradio.com.au.
Oh, it's unlocked. That's why it's so expensive.
Oh, is that what it
is?
Yeah. Good. All right. Until same time next week, it's bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron Panelis, Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC. The crew wish to thank all the stations that take the show, including 3WBC and 3XX in Melbourne, Cairns FM, Switch 1197 in Brisbane, 95.3 Huon FM in Tasmania, Queer FM in WA, and Stop and Go Radio in the United States. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.